Hello, Britain. And as the sun rises over the Italian-designed Qatari Finance Shard in London, over French-built Windsor Castle and Greek-designed German-owned Mini Cooper, and over Mr. Bean and a Dalek, all featured on the Sun's front-page portrait of post-Brexit Britain, we welcome you back to Romaniacs. I'm Dorian Linsky, back after a week off. Like David Davis, I threatened to resign, but used my SAS training to secure a better deal. This week, we'll be experiencing extreme withdrawal pains as we try to make sense of the government's EU exit bill. 3 weeks in the Lords, 40 hours and counting in the Commons, and they're still debating the dog end of it as we record on Wednesday afternoon. Was it a pathetic climb down from the government, a sweeping victory for Theresa May, a family-sized helping of fudge, or what? Our panel know the answer. Returning to the show after too long a break, it's Ros Taylor, Research Manager of the Truth, Trust and Technology Commission at the London School of Economics. Three areas where there's pretty much nothing to talk about right now.
Nothing at all. Let's move on.
Welcome back, Ros.
Oh, hello.
We had the exciting news the BBC are going to rebroadcast the whole of their referendum report on Saturday, 23rd of June, all 11 hours of it. And you said you thought that was quite a good idea. My therapist disagrees. Explain.
Well, selfishly, I didn't actually get to watch the coverage because I was at the LSE that night chairing things and banging on and stuff. And so I didn't get to watch TV much. So I haven't seen it, actually. But if I had, no. I actually think it would be good to remind ourselves of what the prevailing mood was at the time. It would be good to remind ourselves of what was being promised, the lies that were being told, what both sides were saying that, you know, did and didn't turn out to be true. And it would just be a useful look back, a useful corrective. Painful, but useful.
Do you think that you might spot a contradiction or two between what they said on the night, the Brexiters said on the night, what they're saying now?
I might. If I looked hard enough.
Well, if you can bear it, please be our guest. Meanwhile, all sensible people will be at the pro-European March for a People's Vote on Saturday, 23rd of June, in the morning from 10:30. Be there and make sure it's an event nobody can ignore. Also with us is Ian Dunt, editor of politics.co.uk. Hello, Ian.
Hello.
Did you enjoy having to record an emergency podcast in a park last week? Because so much had happened. It sounded very jolly.
It was quite nice, wasn't it? There was young people that were having much more fun than we were, but like, as they always do, apparently. No, it was really nice. It was quite sunny. It was all good. I was feeling quite upbeat about things, and then I came back and the week started and everything's been a fucking shit show.
How's the withdrawal bill affecting your schedule at the moment?
Pretty severely. Yesterday was rather a lot of work, but it's happening now and we've managed to escape to Soho, so you know, things are on the up.
Also suffering from exit bill insomnia is our special guest, Raphael Baer, columnist at The Guardian, political commentator of the year 2014 in the Editorial Intelligence Comment Awards, and writer for Prospect magazine. Hello, Raph. Welcome to Romaniacs.
Thank you for having me.
Given your experience of kind of big days in Parliament, how did the withdrawal bill measure up? Top 10?
Actually, not really, to be honest. I mean, obviously, it's significant. I think, first of all, the problem partly with the debate is it's nowhere near as significant as a lot of the people involved in it sort of think, because they're arguing about an idea of Brexit that's very parochial. There's still a lot of people arguing about Brexit as if the UK has total control and what would be the ideal thing to do. And so a lot of the debate bore no relationship at all to what's actually available in the actual negotiation, which is the actual Brexit that's happening in Brussels. But also, it was just, in terms of parliamentary theatre, you had this weird thing, because there was a vote on a sequence of amendments, and the really interesting one was this, the decision on whether or not Parliament will get, I can't do air quotes on the radio, can I, on the podcast, but, you know, in quotes, a meaningful vote on the final deal. But that was sort of the last in a series of amendments. So there was, it's this weird situation where there's about an hour of just voting, with MPs sort of trooping around. And then you had to sort of wait to get the result of the vote that you wanted. So it was sort of that element of it was a bit like in the old days of like watching CFAX to try and get the news, just like, sort of waiting for the page to turn. But there was something I've never seen before. That in terms of, again, parliamentary theatre, the really interesting thing was on that meaningful vote amendment, essentially. God, it gets so complicated. But to cut a long story short, the government really, really, really doesn't want to be defeated. It's really humiliating. But they also really don't want to concede too much to a bunch of Tory rebels who said that you were insisting on that the meaningful vote actually have some kind of meaning. And so, I've never seen this before. They ended up negotiating with the rebels from the front bench. So Robert Buckland, who's the Solicitor General, was sort of intervening in the debate as if contributing to the debate, but actually sort of talking to the rebels, saying, "And I'm very interested in this thing that you're saying, because we might basically be able to compromise on that." And then sort of crouching down and then taking people out of the chamber, and it was all, it was like a really boring technical bedroom farce, if such a thing can exist. There's also running around and sort of talking behind benches. And then eventually the rebels sort of accepted the offer that was being made to them, although no one seems to know what that offer is. And so the rebellion sort of collapsed because they got what they wanted, or had they? So it ended up being very messy in the end. There was no very satisfying fifth act, last scene, everyone's dead on stage moment.
Is it? I mean, we're going to talk about that, the debate in more detail later, but is it exciting seeing, you know, red-hot democracy up close and personal, people running around and having heated conversations?
If you're into that sort of thing, yeah, and I am, to be honest. Yeah. No, I do. I, and, you know, there's no denying that the you know, I'm very lucky to have a job where I get to write down what I think about stuff and people pay me for it, which is madness. But the other bit of it that I really like is that you get to sit in a chamber and you watch this stuff happening. And again, if I'm being really critical, then sort of don myself, you know, parliamentary theatre critic hat on. There weren't many great interventions, to be honest. Ken Clark was pretty good. But, you know, there wasn't, like, you know, there was, remember that moment in the Syria debate a couple of years ago where Hilary Benn did this speech? It was just phenomenal. It was, you know, parliamentary theatre at its best. And whether you agreed with him or not, you just wanted to, you know, give it a nice ovation. There was a lot of rambly reading off notes and a lot of giving the government line to take and making arguments that have been very thoroughly refuted before. It lacked a bit of fizz, to be honest.
And just before the bill came to the Commons, you wrote a big piece for The Guardian saying that effectively a soft Brexit was kind of signed off months ago. And
yeah, this is the sort of the point I was making a moment ago about the schism between Brexit as it's discussed 99% of the time in this country and Brexit, the actual thing that you might be able to negotiate as a deal. And, you know, one is an event, you know, this heroic moment of liberation. With a single bound, we are free from the yoke of foreign rule. And then the other one is a process that's going to go on for 10, 15 years. Even after you've done a deal, you're going to be refining the deal and working out the terms. And so the point I made there is that the moment at which those two sort of meanings of the word Brexit split, the sort of sliding doors moment, was actually the phase one agreement, the joint report in December, where Theresa May promised essentially two things. She said there'll be an invisible border in Northern Ireland, and to the EU and the Irish, she said that, and to the DUP, she said there will be absolutely no change in the arrangements that mean there's a significant difference in the settlement for Northern Ireland and mainland UK. Now, you can't do that. You can't achieve those two things without soft Brexit. So you can shaft the DUP or you can crash out of the EU, but to actually satisfy the promises that were made in December, you're doing soft Brexit. And the problem is that the Tories sort of signed off on that because they just wanted something to be able to cheer and go, yeah, we're making progress, Brexit is working. And they've just spent the last 6 months, because that was December, sort of pretending that that's not what happened and arguing about a Brexit that everyone in Brussels will tell you doesn't actually exist, which is the Max Fact customs partnership, ways of alchemy, ways of restoring a border that isn't a real border and all that stuff. And meanwhile, everyone on the European side is looking across and going, well, I don't know what this Brexit you're talking about is. We've got a Brexit. It's written down in the joint report. As soon as you want to come and talk to us about that Brexit, we're ready for you. And that sort of feel is coming to a head now. The two Brexits have to now rejoin and become one thing again at some point.
One super Brexit.
Yay.
But also a slightly meta question. You're saying that there is a big difference between kind of the reality and what is being presented to most of the country. What do you think of your job at The Guardian? Who are you speaking to? What are you trying to explain that you think people, you know, need to know most of all?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's a dilemma because the reality is a lot of our readers, not people who read me, I think we know this debate is so polarised. So there is always a temptation. You can just do the sort of playing to the gallery and sort of going on about how completely bonkers Brexit is, and you'll get a few hits off that. I think the more interesting...
Works for us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. You've got to put food on the table, right? But no, I think the more interesting element of it, there are two sort of things. One, people do tune out and it is very technical and they're the hardest. But one of the reasons we are in the mess we are in is that it's extremely hard to articulate the facts of the way the European Union works in a way that's interesting and readable. And a lot of I've spoken at events, and what will happen is people will say, why didn't you make the case for the European Union years and years and years ago? And to which the answer is the two answers. One is way more people read the Daily Mail and the Express than read the Guardian. Sorry, if you want to go out and shift copies of The Guardian for us, please do. But actually, you know, I'm the wrong person to be asking that or making that complaint to. But the other one is, I promise you, I tried. But, you know, when I used to write columns for The Observer or even, you know, Leader column or in The Guardian, and you say, right, what I really want to do is explain how actually the European Council is the decision-making body of the European Union. It's not the Commission. The thing is, it's not run. And at the European Council, it's a UK Prime Minister who is there speaking on behalf of the UK. So there's no them and us. Actually, when we talk about things that the European Union has done, these are things we have done to ourselves, expressed through our own head of government, where most of the time we have a veto and we've never been defeated on a qualified majority voting basis. Let me explain qualified majority voting.
I've already said
exactly,
this.
Exactly. And that was what, about 300-400 words that I just said there?
Yeah.
You know, that you've got to put an intro in it. It's really, really hard. And if you're up against basically but straight bananas, it's not, the pitch is really skewed. So it is the difficulty of, you know, and in that piece that you described, what I was trying to do is just find a way of articulating what is available, which is immensely technical, in a way that will also, someone will have read it to the end. And that in itself is just hard.
You are absolutely right. I used to commission comment for The Guardian, and it was very difficult to, I mean, it was just easier not to, because when if you mentioned something like this in news conference, you could see people's eyes glazing over, no matter how you sold it. And it was also, there were very few people who wanted to write about it. So, you know, to your credit, Raphael, you were one of them. But the oppositional, the way that we did comment at the time, which was very kind of, I'm totally for this or I'm totally against this, didn't lend itself to talking about the EU because it's not really that kind of subject.
Exactly.
And then, of course, you've also got to sell a piece online. You've got to sell it in the headline or a trail. Very hard to do that with Europe. Very hard. Whereas if you're reading it in the paper, you might be prepared to give it a second chance.
Well, I read Ralph's piece to the end.
Yay!
It was very good. Don't test me on the last line, but I did. We'll be doing the withdrawal bill in hypnotic detail later, but first, there were other Brexit happenings this week, not least the revelations about Aaron Banks' meeting with the Russians in the run-up to the referendum. We'll get to them after these reminders.
If you want to help Romaniacs keep up the good fight against Brexit, the best way to do it is to back us on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Pledge a small amount each month towards the show and you can get the much sought after Romaniacs t-shirt so you can put some Romaine in your wardrobe, the stylish Romaniacs mug suitable for drinking exciting European coffee as well as strong British tea, and early discount access to our live shows. Special alert, there's an announcement coming up soon. Visit patreon.com/romaniacscast to find out more. And if you enjoy Romaniacs, why not try our sibling podcast, Big Mouth, an hour of quality pop culture chat with some of Britain's best music and film journalists, often including Dorian, every Saturday morning. Search for Big Mouth in the Apple Podcasts app or go to audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth.
OK, let's have a look at the infinitely renewable resource that is Brexit news. First up, those revelations at the weekend about Leave.eu boss Aaron Banks' extensive hidden connections with the Russians prior to the referendum, and Banks' subsequent typically arrogant appearance before the media committee. The Sunday Times reported on emails showing that Banks and Leave.eu Director of Communications Andy Wigmore had met with the Russian ambassador three times, not once as they previously claimed. Among other things, the emails reveal that the Russians had offered them a business deal on gold mines. The meetings were set up by the same Russian spy, later expelled from Britain over the Salisbury poisonings. Sounds legit. And Banks and Wigmore exchanged regular messages with Russian officials, including invitations to parties and discussions of trips to Moscow. Banks' former ghostwriter, the alleged journalist Isabel Oakeshott, took the story to the Sunday Times after she got wind that the Observer were running it and acted shocked that Banks and Wigmore's activities conflicted with the public accounts they'd given. Oakeshott said that the email suggested poor innocent Banks and Wigmore were shamelessly used by the Russians, but claimed that nothing in the email invalidates the judgment of the 17.4 million people who voted for Brexit. In other words, leave one so nothing else counts. Ian, will Oakeshott win some sort of special Pulitzer for discovering an amazing story that had been hiding in her attic for 2 years?
Yeah, she is, I have to say, one of those journalists who I particularly detest. She has a long history of this kind of stuff. If you think way back to the sort of Vicky Price stuff with Chris Hoon, where there was a case where, you know, the CPS actually under Keir Starmer insisted that they show people who their source was. Their source, of course, is Vicky Price, but if she gave up her source, she was going to go to jail. Now, they fought that, And then they stopped just before they went to appeal, and she gave up her source. So those that old-fashioned stuff of, oh, no, well, I will never give up our source, I would rather go to jail. It's like, well, actually, in this case, you would rather not go to an appeal in order to give up your source. And then she had, of course, another special moment later on with the David Cameron sticks his imaginary dick in an imaginary pig moment, which was basically someone who she later admitted seemed quite unstable, telling her something at a party and deciding that it was worth reporting. So by the time you get to the stage of, we're just going to sit on something that is pertinent for 2 years and not report it, and then to go on the Daily Politics, you may remember her against Carol Cadwalla, saying, well, fine, if you're going to report this, then why aren't you doing something for Remain? All of that time, she has sat there with those files showing that her own side, so she, of course, had ghostwritten Banks's book that has an inaccurate description of how many times she'd met the Russian ambassador. She was failing to report that as well. So by this stage, you sort of think, like, there's no more reason that this person should be cropping up on our feeds ever again.
You can't, well, you can't really have her on television again after the unicorns remark to Carol Cadwalla, can you?
I mean, I think that they will do gross. So because there's just this sort of thing of you just keep on keeping the status that you had. But I think by this, you know, by this point, you really have to raise questions as to her adequacy and the position that she's in.
Raph, Banks has, as usual, dismissed the whole thing as a Remainer conspiracy. Do these revelations change the direction of the story? We've already had the Electoral Commission fine, criminal investigation.
Yeah, I think there are two elements to this. An important one is to sort of zoom right out and think, well, you know, why would the Russians want to influence the referendum? And if they would they be on the side of Leave? And the answer is because essentially, you know, it's for a long time going way back. It's been in, you know, I mean, I was a correspondent in Moscow many years ago. And I remember the sort of the Kremlin foreign policy position. They hated the European Union. It just contradicted everything about the way the Russians wanted to do foreign policy. They want to basically deal with nation states. They want it to be like the 19th century. You've got big powers. It's all a big game of chess. And then you've got this institution that sits there, does everything by committee. They all meet in Brussels. It sort of amplifies the power of annoying little countries like Lithuania and Latvia and Slovenia up to the same sort of level as Germany and France. And that makes no sense from a Kremlin point of view. So they really hate the EU, basically. Strategically, they don't like it. They want to undermine it. So, right, so that's the big picture. So obviously, if Vladimir Putin could have had a vote in the referendum, there's absolutely no doubt at all he would have voted Leave. Right. And then you have the thing that we already know also, which is that, you know, the Russians and security services are in the business of sort of stoking division and polarizing and trying to destabilize liberal Western democracies, again, because it makes for good sort of strategic Russian interest to have the countries of the West that they generally see as either enemies or strategic rivals in a sense of turmoil. So I think, you know, one way or another, I think it's absolutely certain that, you know, insofar as there was a bit of a budget kicking around down sort of, you know, FSB HQ to have a bit of a go on the referendum, fire up a few bots, see what you could do, they would be on the side of Leave. Now, the separate issue to that is, if you find some smoking gun somewhere, some smoking Twitter bot somewhere that absolutely pins this on Banks or Farage and all the others, and it's still, you know, it's still in the area of murk and uncertainty, would that dramatically change the calculus in terms of whether Britain's leaving the European Union? My instinct is still not really. That whole tedious 17.4 million, which bit of Leave don't you understand? Mm. You know, there's no one in the country who will turn around and go, do you know what? There might be some, but there aren't many who can think, do you know what? I really wanted to leave the EU because this guy called Vladimir actually came up to me and told me to do it. And now that I realised who it was, you know, underneath the fake moustache, now I'm really cross and now I want to stay in the EU. That's not a dynamic that's involved in this. But it does at least contribute to this mood music around the whole thing, that it's just not simple anymore. It's murky and complicated, and ultimately, you know, it's not the proposition that you had in 2016, which is like, this is going to be basically a piece of piss, we just leave, what's so hard about that? That proposition is dying, and that does change the dynamic a bit.
Banks was booked to appear on Newsnight, but decided to subject himself instead to the forensic grilling of Nigel Farage on LBC. Not so much Frost Nixon as Nixon. Then he had to appear before the Media Committee fake news hearing, where he walked out for lunch before it ended. How long can he sort of front this out, and how much is his sort of Trumpian suggestion that Parliament itself is fake news going to play?
I think that the Trump thing is a very apt comparison, not that he's any sort of in the same league, but because what the whole thing demonstrates an understanding that a lot of politics now is about performance. That walking out for lunch was an act, was a performative act, and it works. You know, frustratingly, you know, it's going to get a lot of traction. It'll be clips on Facebook and shared in all the sort of sinister Facebook groups where people think that sort of thing's terribly clever, and also shared by people who think it's despicable. But, you know, ultimately, you know, the reality is Leave.eu wasn't the main campaign vehicle for the Leave campaign. And it will, a lot of this will come down to whether or not that committee, the DCMS, the Select Committee, can grow itself into an institution of British public life and democracy with real clout. And Select Committees, you know, journalists always say the terribly influential Parliamentary Select Committee, normally when they've got a scoop about some report from a Select Committee, basically, you know. So an influential Select Committee is one that everyone's reported. A very influential one is where you've got first sight of the report. But the reality is they don't have powers of subpoena like the, you know, congressional ones. They don't have the same heft. The few of the chairs of these committees, I mean, Damian Collins is pretty good, but few of them have the heft, you know, equivalent to the best American senators. There is talk about trying to get some sort of souped up super committee to really investigate some of this stuff. That might be a scoop, by the way, to try and get some like proper parliamentary body.
It's very influential.
The super ultra influential, you know, unbeatable mega committee. The sort of Optimus Prime of parliamentary committees. To try and basically take this forward, because there's so many different bits of it swirling around, the fake news, the money, the Russians. But at the moment, it's still just a Select Committee. And that is, yeah, that's championship, not premiership, British institutional politics.
And Andy Wigmore, the former director of communications for Leave.eu, told the committee something that I thought was very revealing. So the piece of advice we got right from the beginning was, remember, referendums are not about facts, it's about emotion, and you've got to tap into that. Which kind of really gets to the heart of the mess that we're in.
They've been saying that for ages. In fact, I mean, Banks then during the committee said, look, we led lots of journalists up the garden path on plenty of things. So by the time that he sat in the committee saying we're prepared to just make shit up as much as we like, of course you get to the point where Collins has sat there going, well, on that basis, it's very hard for us to come to an assessment on the validity of the stuff that you're saying to us right now. And that, of course, plays directly into the way that the Russians operate. Like, if you look at, like I recently did a podcast on sort of the fake news bit, and it was about the little green men in Crimea, who are these guys that sort of came in, clearly Russian soldiers, but didn't have any of the insignia, didn't have the uniforms, didn't have the flags on them. And no one could tell whether it was really happening or whether it wasn't really happening. And then when you look at the way that you have the Ukrainian troll farms that are paid for, it's that same thing. You're on a gardening forum. You're on a cookery forum. These guys are there to just nudge conversations in a pro-Kremlin direction. Again, you never really... It's not about something is definitely a lie. It's not about finding the smoking gun. It's about never really being sure when something is true or false.
Yeah, and the more outrageous that Banks and Wigmore are walking out of the committee and so on, the more they just don't give a toss, the less shocked we are. It's just like Trump. The more outrageous he is, the less we expect him to tell the truth. So the expectation is gone and nobody cares anymore. And as you say, there's a general cynicism that just pervades the whole process.
Raph, was there something you noticed in Moscow, the what I call the kind of, you know, nothing is true, everything is permitted approach, that where you, that part of the lying and the disinformation is to actually break down people's sense that there is a distinction between what is true and what is false, and that one can ever find out the difference, and therefore... You know, it gives you this sort of like postmodern playground in which to.
Absolute point. Although I think that as a kind of a strategic objective of active misinformation really started after I'd left. So I was there, you know, sort of turn of the millennium and a bit after. But it's interesting that you asked that, because what I did definitely find, and this is something that I experienced before all the sort of the latest sort of rash of allegations came out, even before I think the sort of Russian alleged collusion, obvious actual collusion with the Trump campaign. Came out, which was that there was something about the referendum campaign and British politics that was sort of basically doing my head in, and I was finding this very awkward business that just, and you know, either just sort of the frenzy around it, difficulty in pinning stuff down, and as you say, just a sense of people just flagrantly lying and getting away with it, and I couldn't work out what it was. And again, sorry, and the very pervasive cynicism, people just saying, well, you know, your Project Fear is meaningless, and well, you say the Leave campaign lied, but the Treasury lied too. It's like, well, not in the same degree and not in the same way. There are actually degrees, measures of truth, and it is, you can at least aspire to be honest, and all these things. But the cloud of sort of nihilism and cynicism that I found myself sort of working in. And then it really, I promise you, it just struck me out of nowhere. I thought, oh my God, this is what it was like working in Moscow. It was long before this had happened. I just thought, I knew this was familiar. It's like that kind of way you sort of get a familiar smell and it immediately transports you back. It was that. It was like projected back to you. Oh God, this is why I left Moscow, because it just felt like banging your head against the wall. The truth. You know, not only did you just not think it was going to be ultimately available, nearly everyone had agreed it wasn't going to be available, and why would anyone be such a mug as to try and find it out? That culture was very strong. And to start to smell that in the air here, I found shocking and very demoralising.
Great.
Yeah, but on the upside, I got quite good at drinking vodka.
Meanwhile, in further right news, there were violent scenes in central London last weekend as supporters of the jailed extremist and former EDL leader Tommy Robinson threw missiles and smoke bombs at police in patriotic fashion. Robinson was jailed for contempt of court after breaching reporting restrictions on a trial in Leeds Crown Court, which risked collapsing that trial. Thousands of demonstrators appeared in Whitehall on Saturday. There were 5 arrests, a tourist bus was taken over and vandalised, and protesters were seen making Nazi salutes. But on the lighter side, the accidental fascists managed to synchronise their march with a naked bike ride. And news management hit new highs when a Robinson supporter tried to pass off pictures of Liverpool FC's victory procession after winning the 2005 Champions League as the whole of London turning out to demand freedom for Our Tommy. He didn't call him Our Tommy, but you know he wanted to. Even though St George's Hall, the team's bus and most of Liverpool were all clearly visible. Roz, this was a bit Weimar, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
How concerned should we be?
We should be concerned about the kinds of people who were supporting these rioters, who included Gerald Batten, the new leader of UKIP. Nigel Farage, I noticed, was very much distancing himself from Gerald Batten, because we know that Nigel doesn't like to hang out with the kind of people who run down streets smashing things. It's more afternoon on the golf course for Nigel. It is worrying to me how much of a crossover there is between this demo, which had some kind of standard type of protesters that you might normally see, football thugs, basically the kind of people who were doing, who have done this kind of thing every few years for the last few decades, and mainstream-ish politics.
And this came at the same time that the sort of members of the neo-Nazi group National Action are on trial for plotting to murder Labour MP Rosie Cooper and DC Victoria Henderson. These are people that had applauded the murder of Joe Cox. And obviously they weren't on the march because they were in jail awaiting trial.
Yeah.
But this obviously is all very unnerving. I wonder how do we place this in the context of Brexit? Because obviously we've seen the sort of collapse of UKIP really as a legitimate party and kind of returning to its sort of the creepier fringes. Can we sort of go, well, has this been legitimised by the rhetoric around Brexit? What explains this kind of far-right resurgence?
I don't think it's got much to do with Brexit, because Brexit has been mainstreamed. If you really care about Brexit, there are plenty of political parties and people in the public eye who are expressing your views about it. This is of a different order, but it does come out of some of the same trends that help bring about Brexit. One of the reasons, one of the interesting things about this for me was that Tommy Robinson was put in jail because of contempt of court. Basically, he was broadcasting outside a court on Facebook, and I think his video got 250,000 views. This was in contempt of court, and it was very much in contempt of court. It wasn't just one-off tweet that was a bit ill-advised. He was doing it pretty deliberately. And the ironic thing, of course, is that contempt of court is designed to protect the rights of people who might have previous convictions, who are in court, and people who find themselves in this position, like Tommy Robinson himself. And that's the terrible irony here, that by breaking the contempt of court rules, he is undermining his own search for justice. But it reveals a lot about the way we expect, and his supporters expect, to see every aspect of the justice process, to see every aspect of what their leaders are thinking. And that's very much a trend in modern politics, where they will feel denied if a judge says, no, you can't write about this, you can't broadcast this. And there's also a problem, of course, with Facebook itself, which is not liable for this kind of broadcast, but arguably could have got there a bit quicker in not letting it be broadcast, but it's got so much stuff to monitor that it's always going to have difficulty doing that. The expectation that you should be able to see everything, that there should be total transparency about the justice system, and anything else is an establishment cover-up and is a denial of justice, is what I think is behind this demo in the ultimately.
It sort of seems like there's a real kind of, that when UKIP was doing very well, there were obviously some very creepy people in that party, and there were also a lot of people who would normally vote Labour or Tory and, you know, had particular concerns. Whereas now it just seems that, you know, we're sort of boiling it down to a hardcore that seems very similar to the people I saw on BNP marches.
Yeah, I think there's two things going on here. I think that's right, broadly. I mean, there has always been a far right in the UK, and it ebbs and flows and depends on how competent or able the leadership is. I mean, I'm just about old enough to remember in the late 1970s when the NF got quite strong and the country was in a mess and there was a Labour government. And, I mean, it's a terrible generalisation, but through the 80s, you had, again, with the dynamic you've just described, that a sort of, wouldn't necessarily say sort of fascist curious, but a sort of hard right, nationalist, extremely patriotic feeling basically got scooped up by the Thatcher movement, and the NF just sort of collapsed. And then it was under the coalition government, you know, Cameron, his sort of Metro Notting Hill liberalism in coalition with Clegg, you know, obviously created a sort of cultural space where, again, the hard right felt very disenfranchised, and they'd sat through New Labour, they'd sat through this, they thought they might be getting their country back, and then they got all this awful Cameronism, and so they were very, very angry, and that fed the Brexit mood. But again, sort of UKIP sort of amplified that, but also sort of became, so warehoused some of that feeling. And now that sort of exploded out in a Brexit vote, among the other reasons why people voted to leave the EU. And my great concern now is that, I mean, a Tory MP described to me the UKIP, put it very well, said it's a bit like the bee that stings you and then leaves the sting in you, and then the messenger bee dies. So UKIP is like the rest of that bee, but you've still got the sting. Now, my concern is that as we discussed earlier, the promises that were made on behalf of Brexit that simply can't be delivered in terms of immigration, in terms of just, you know, a general feeling that your country is going to be better and improved and feel like it was in some nebulous past through your childhood, that where it was, everything was just whiter and cleaner, metaphorically and literally. These things cannot be satisfied, and someone is going to have to be to blame. You know, when they aren't satisfied. Now, Michael Gove and Boris Johnson are not going to say, OK, Nazis, blame us. We made some false promises here. You know, how bad are they? And the Daily Mail is not going to print a front page going, you know what, skinheads, yeah, don't, you know, if you want to be angry with us, right? We really led you down the garden path on this one, are they? So there is going to be a lot of anger, and it's going to have to be channeled somewhere. And that's where I worry. I'm less sort of phlegmatic than Ros is about this, that I think there is a Brexit angle to this, which is that we are looking at some very dry tinder, if you see what I mean.
Finally, in a desperate bid for a bit of levity, there won't be any commemorative Brexit stamps, but there will be Dad's Army stamps. The Royal Mail will mark the show's 50th anniversary with a set featuring Captain Mannering, Private Pike and other characters from the beloved sitcom with their catchphrases. Inevitably, it's been linked with Brexit, and inevitably by us. And we conducted a Twitter poll to see which stamp best sums up our exit from the European Union. Don't Panic is the Boris Johnson tribute. We're Doomed, obviously Project Fear. Spivvy Private Walker telling us it won't cost you much. Probably Boris Johnson again. But the clear winner was the second class stamp featuring Sergeant Wilson and his catchphrase, "Do you think that's wise, sir?" Now, when I saw these stamps on Twitter, I actually thought that somebody had mocked them up as a joke, because the phrases seemed so Brexit relevant. The Royal Mail does not strike me as a kind of trolling organisation. But, I mean, do you think there is some wry humour behind this?
Well, there's certainly one that says, "Don't panic." And since Boris Johnson was telling us only last week, not us, but a think tank, not to panic, that seems entirely appropriate. It looks like all those posters you see more and more of all the time that people put up saying, "Don't panic, have a cup of tea," whatever it is. Yeah. So that seems to me very appropriate.
That's the most ubiquitous poster of the last decade and a half.
I fucking hate those. I see those and I think, oh God, you're a write-off, aren't you? It's just, sorry. It's like, oh. Let me panic if I want to.
What about the witty ones like, keep calm and listen to Steely Dan?
Jesus, that's even worse. God, I just can't. No, I mean, it's Dad's Army. It's basically a celebration of British incompetence, isn't it? So what could be more Brexity?
Ian, obviously you're a keen fan of Dad's Army.
Oh, no, I am. No, I like Dad's Army. This is because of this the fucking young thing. No, I know it. Like, I used to watch it with my dad when I was growing up. And even now, like, when I get home and I'm a bit too drunk to properly pay attention to something, I'll whack it on Netflix or
you
whatever.
You turn on Dave, don't you, and you watch Dad's Army. Yeah, whatever no, it's not on. So much. What is it on?
It's when it's on Netflix, basically, which is the only thing that I would watch. And even, like, actually, when you watch it as an adult, I didn't even pick up on any of the class stuff when I was younger, you know, that basically, you know, that I can't remember any of the names of the characters, but that, you know, the number two is much posher than the number one and all of that stuff. I never got that when I was a kid. It's quite rich, actually. It's pretty good. And this must be Royal Mail. Like, I genuinely do believe that this is them trolling. I can't see any other explanation for how these came out.
Well, I've been reading about the sort of history of the Home Guard recently, and it is a kind of quite a... It's quite a sort of poignant story because it was set up because all these people wanted to do something because they thought there was going to be a German invasion. And this only happened for, really, I think it was a very short time, summer of 1940, and people thought that, and the government didn't want them to do anything. And it just said it was all very annoying and just like, let us get on with it. And then they sort of had to, they were sort of bumped into setting up the Home Guard to avoid basically loads of vigilantes. It was to give them sort of a home. And you had some people... including, I may have mentioned him before, George Orwell, you know, who genuinely was expecting there would be guerrilla warfare like he'd seen in Spain. And he was all for basically kind of armed people with, like, you know, hand grenades and spotting kind of windows that would make good machine gun nests. And so it was such a kind of strange... And then, of course, after that, it settled down into, I suppose, what we see in Dad's Army, people knowing that they're actually not going to be needed. But it started with this kind of mad... thing of, like, we may need to be gunning down German invaders in the streets.
That's the fascinating thing, that we never had to. And it would have been been great fun to do a kind of counterfactual where Dad's Army, there was actually a German invasion. And
that would make the last episode of Blackadder Goes Forth.
Yeah, exactly.
Lighthearted romp.
I would love to see that. And would they go all Vichy and start, you know, deporting? Or would they actually die gloriously on the end of a German bayonet?
Half of them would be in camps and half of them would be collaborators. It would be horrifying.
Who wants to do the TV special where Dad's Army gets sent to a camp? It's unbelievably bleak.
It might be time to panic. The epic withdrawal bill showdown in the Commons turned into a bit of an anticlimax, as we discussed earlier, with both sides claiming victory. I'm not even going to attempt to blag my way through an intro. Ian, you kick it off. What's the state of play as of late Wednesday afternoon?
We don't know, because we don't really know what was offered. We don't know if what was offered to one group, i.e. the Tory moderates, Tory rebels, is the same as what is being assured to the hardline Brexiters and the European Research Group. What we do know is we woke up that morning, instead of getting the Lords Amendment that we were expecting, which put a November date on the point that Parliament would take back control if there was no deal, we instead were given... Dominic Greaves's compromise amendment. That basically said, look, we'll have a vote in November by November 30th, but it's not until halfway through February that Parliament would take back control if there's no deal. Now, that just gives you 6 weeks. This is an interesting sort of distinction here, because for a lot of Remainers, the reason they really liked the idea of this was because it gave some kind of obvious vehicle for there to be another referendum or for there to be early stages for Parliament to be able to say, go back and negotiate again, with enough time to spare, technically, just about, before we actually got to Brexit Day. Now, Greaves' motivation is not that, I don't think. Greaves' motivation is how to make sure there can be no deal. So for him, it is absolutely fine to shunt that off into the middle of February. I have to say I don't really understand why that was put down. In the end, if there were 17 people who were apparently going into that room with Theresa May, then that is enough to defeat the government on the numbers that it got here. I don't see why the vote was not just done on the original Lords Amendment rather than the one that we actually got, which is on really Greaves's one, became this mechanism that just sucked everything in. Now, they were picked off one by one. Ruff was talking about how that took place earlier. And given these assurances, the assurances seem to be on the first two stages of his compromise and not on the third. So the first stage is, within 7 days of a deal being done, you have to come back and have a vote in the House of Commons. Second one is that November 30th
There's no deal. Government needs to say what it's going to do and we'll have a vote on it. Although even now, there are already people saying that there's not going to be a binding vote that takes place on those. It would just be some kind of piece of theatre. So at the moment, it's very, very hard to see which way this thing can go. My hunch, however, is they gave in because they thought, look, we can see what you write down. They have to do it this week. Send it to the Lords. So by next week, we'll be able to see what is in that thing. The Lords will then be able to knock this back to the Commons, and that rebellion can take place again next week if indeed the government doesn't live up to its promises.
Raph, there are a lot of criticisms flying around of various people. Some people think that Dominic Grieve played his hand badly. Some people unhappy about Chukwuma talking about the EEA vote. Who do you think, in terms of sort of strategy, who do you think's played this very well, and who do you think has maybe botched it?
I can't believe these words are going to come out of my mouth, but actually I think the person who's at the moment seems to
Don't say it.
Is actually Theresa May. because, which only the bar's low, right? Okay, let's just be clear about that. We're not talking about, you know, the heroic strategic brilliance. It's just that, you know, everyone's, you know, a mess. And she has, what she appears to have done quite effectively is play off this anxiety that the Tory moderates. The thing you have to understand about Tory moderates, the rebels, people like Dominic Grieve, Nicky Morgan, Ginogli, these sorts of people, less Ken Clark and Anna Soubry, they've gone off the charts now. They're wild, right? They're feral, right? But most of them are traditionally they're good kids in the class, right? They're the prefects. Dominic Grieve's a former cabinet minister. They're serious people. They're not like their equivalents on the hard Brexit wing, who are just born rebels. You know, they love being rebellious. So they are very, very susceptible to the argument that, you know, which, you know, will have happened, that they were taken aside and said, look, if you defeat the government, all that happens is it bolsters Jeremy Corbyn. It's very bad. You're helping Labour, and they really hate the idea of a Corbyn led government. And, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, we want to help you here. Of course, Theresa's not on the same side as Jacob Rees-Mogg, but, you know, you'd only be helping them if the whole thing looks like a mess. And I think it helps a lot that Robert Buckland, who I mentioned earlier, who's the Solicitor General, was the sort of conduit for this. Because before he joined the government, he was like proper pro-European MP. I mean, I remember when I was a political editor for the New Statesman, you wanted to talk to a Tory MP who'd be reliably pro-European, and you couldn't get Ken Clark on the phone. You got Robert Buckland. Do you know what I mean? He was that guy. So I think he was a very credible person to say to the rebels, look, you know, of course we're not nutters. We understand that you want a meaningful vote, but just don't crash this. You know, don't grab the wheel and steer the government off the road. And the problem is, as I say, the moderates, they're quite susceptible to that sort of thing. They want to help, and they think they're helping. Have they been taken for a ride? Very possibly. Although at the same time, you know, the reality is, if the government publishes an amendment to go into Lords, which has to happen tomorrow, Thursday. And it's really, really weak. There are many, many opportunities now, other bits of legislation for the Tory moderates to rebel harder and more aggressively. And, you know, like everyone, they will not look kindly on being massively humiliated by the government, who's promised something and then tries to pull the rug out from underneath them. So I think it's a bit of a win for them. I think it's part of a slow burn game for Theresa May, just trying to wear out the hard Brexiters, never quite betraying them enough that they pull her down, but just betraying them a teeny tiny bit here and there. And eventually, you know, I think this does nudge the whole thing slightly more towards a soft Brexit, for the reason that Ian said, which is it weaves a bit of a safety net underneath that vote at the end, where it gives people reason to think maybe you can vote down May's deal, because it won't just set fire to the whole country. There is another way.
Well, you wrote a piece this morning about the sort of the ultras. I mean, how much power do they have now? Is there sort of stock falling or rising? Can they really kind of pull the trigger on May?
I think, well, technically, yes, they can, because the mechanism is if you get enough letters into the chair of the 1922 committee, there's automatically a vote of confidence. That doesn't say, it doesn't sack the leader. You have a vote of confidence in the leader, which May could win. So, you know, so they can trigger a process, but they can't necessarily control the process. Crucially, though, actually, you know, so there's that the European research group, and there may be about 60 of those. But actually, how many of those are like full bore 100% Brexit jihadis who will like literally strap on the belt and run at the government and just blow the whole thing up because they just hate the EU so much? They don't care. They don't care if it gives you Jeremy Corbyn as prime minister. They don't care what happens. Just get us out on any terms, right? And how many of them actually are sort of thinking, we'll just get something called Brexit and then we can move on and then we'll fix it afterwards. Once the UK's a third country, once you've got to the 30th of March 2019, there's no going back. You know, the drawbridge has gone up behind us. We're out of the EU and then we'll worry about the bloody details. So, and then you, that gets you more towards the slightly Michael Gove position, which is, you know, or you know, people like Robert Halfen who would think, well, although he actually voted Remain, but Tory MPs who were thinking, OK, yeah, we want Brexit, but oh, do we have to fuss about the details? Can't we just have something that's called Brexit and then talk about other stuff? And actually, I think there's more of a split among the hardliners than you see, and that the number who are absolutely wild-eyed, just don't care anymore, who really aren't bluffing about bringing May down and just, you know, bringing down the whole temple, I don't know how many of those there are. There might not be as many as people think.
So, Roz, there is a line of thought that says the best way to defeat Brexit is in Parliament. How do you think that's going? Do you think that's a misguided strategy?
I think it's wishful thinking. Parliament was given a lovely chance by the Supreme Court to be more active in Brexit. We had that ruling that gave them the decision about whether Article 50 had to be triggered or not. Now you can be pragmatic about it and say, of course, they always had to trigger it. But it seemed to be enough that they could. They didn't actually take advantage of that. Now we're seeing again the wasted opportunity to even have even a straight, fairly straightforward, meaningful vote amendment won't pass, and instead it's replaced by something extremely complicated, cooked up with the Solicitor General whispering things in MPs' ears that the public, vast majority of the public, are never going to understand.
I wouldn't even make that claim.
No,
I don't understand it.
And it's not going to be stopped by Parliament alone. Parliament are cowed, they are afraid. And the reason for that fundamentally is that Brexit is not a thing of Parliament. Brexit is a beast that was born outside Parliament, out of movements like UKIP that have never had a true foothold in Parliament, only I think had a maximum of two MPs at any one time, that came from frustration with austerity, that came with out of frustration and anger and resentment, and coalesced round a cause called Brexit, and was driven by people like Dominic Cummings and Aaron Banks and people who really have nothing to do with Parliament. And that is why Parliament is so afraid of Brexit, because it's not something that comes of it. When Parliament normally looks at legislation and so on, it's things that have been prepared by civil servants, talked about in committees, discussed. This has just come from outside, and they are told they have to do it because it's the will of the people. Most of them still don't want it. Most of them voted against it in the first place, and they're terrified of it. And until we see a signal, a strong signal from the country, from people, that the direction that the country is going in is the wrong one, and despite some polls that are beginning maybe to switch by a few points, we haven't seen that strong signal yet. People are continuing to dig in. I don't think they will have the guts to intervene in a meaningful way. Perhaps not until no deal scenario comes along, or perhaps not even then.
But if we, does that mean, therefore, that we're in a bind that, as Raph was saying, like, it has always been, even at the best of times, difficult to explain the mechanics of the European Union and Britain's relationship with it to the average, even the curious newspaper reader, let alone the average voter. So are they in any place, are voters in any place mentally to take in any of the information that would actually affect their decision and therefore put pressure on MPs? Or are they either just kind of doubling down or tuning out?
We are waiting for, sadly, and this makes me incredibly sad to say, we are waiting for a recession. We are waiting for the steady drip of announcements that X company is pulling hundreds of staff out of Britain, that we haven't got enough workers to pick fruit this year, until it all just becomes so cumulatively great that it begins to seem to Joe Public like a seriously bad idea. And I never wanted it to get this far. I'm not one of those Remainers who says, oh, wait till they see what's come to them. Because it's awful. Because a recession is awful. Because people suffer. Because I don't want that to happen. And yet it seems, unfortunately, more than unfortunately, that is what is going to have to happen.
It was a really dreadful fucking debate. I mean, you know, you're exactly... The fear of MPs is really noticeable. That all of the Brexit
contributions were over and over, will of the people, you're trying to frustrate Brexit. Now, it doesn't matter that that is irrelevant to what was being discussed. That was the only response, because they know that it's irrelevant. But it is the way of putting fear into people. And so over and over, facts just crashed up against this wall. And Parliament, which, you know, given that the referendum was in no small part supposedly about parliamentary sovereignty, just sat there cowed as it handed over powers to the executive. If you take the statutory instrument stuff that was there, statutory instruments are these basically these little mechanisms that turn ministers into little mini parliaments. They can just rub out bits of law if they want. There's varieties of them. You've got negative, you've got positive, affirmative, you've got super affirmative, which give different levels of democratic scrutiny. But none of them have very much democratic scrutiny, even when the affirmative instruments are very, very, very weak. They can just chuck these things through. There were measures there in the sifting committee or in order to basically give it a bit more democratic scrutiny that were just passed through one after another they were voted on. And how were they voted on? They were voted on without any fucking debate whatsoever on the Commons floor. They were barely even mentioned because the government had only given it 6 hours on that day, another 6 hours today. So by controlling the timetable, then MPs loyally go in, vote for the government timetable, which is specifically designed to make sure they cannot debate this stuff. Then they go in and they loyally vote to give the government the powers that they themselves should be having on 40 years worth of law and just pass it over. To see Parliament do that while people are braying about giving Parliament back control is just an absolute horrific fucking spectacle to go through. So it was very hard by the end of yesterday to have much faith in the institution whatsoever, I'd say. And then when we put so much of our faith in the final vote of what happens when the deal comes back to Parliament, you know, I don't want to be mean about it because I know what politics is like. You have to make concessions, you have to make compromises. But to look at some of those Tory MPs who could have won that vote yesterday and think that they're backing down here, it suddenly becomes pretty easy to imagine how the government would put the fear into them when it comes to that vote coming back to the Commons. And that's really when we are absolutely screwed. Like, if there's no rebellion there, it is game over. And I have to say, looking at them yesterday, I just didn't see enough bravery, enough spine, enough resilience to suggest that they will hold firm when it really counts.
Yeah, I was really disappointed by Dominic Grieve. I thought that the meaningful vote amendment might have passed on its own if others had had the guts to follow Philip Lee's resignation and there was a chance of that happening. Instead, we get this incredibly complicated alternative amendment from Grieve, which was lawyerly and was no doubt very clever, as we are saying, was completely incomprehensible to the vast majority of the public. And it was sad to see somebody who I know does care about Brexit reduced to being a very, very good QC.
Well, we're in, obviously, we're kind of in the thick of it at the moment. When the sort of history of this horrible period is written, what do you think, Ian, will have come out of today? What is kind of, what is nailed down? What really matters once all the kind of the theatres and the fudges have been forgotten?
I have to go slightly on a limb because we haven't seen it yet and there's lots of claims and counterclaims as to what's in there.
Yeah.
And people will have seen it by the time that this goes out. So I'm slightly on a limb, but from what we understand, it's in three parts, as we were talking earlier. So one of them is the vote 7 days after the deal. One of them is the vote if there's no deal by November 30th. And the other one is the vote of what happens in the middle of February if there's no deal by then. Okay, only the last part triggers the great English Civil War part two bit where Parliament takes back control over the executive. It seems like the first two are secured in terms of a date on the vote. Now, that does matter because before we had ministers saying we will put it to you before we put it to the English Parliament, but nothing had actually been put down in law. This would put down a date in law, and if they have got it there, a binding vote in law. So that does matter. That gives us a battleground. And remember, David Davis has admitted if there's a motion going before the House, it can be amended. So in terms of being able to put things like, we demand you go back to the negotiating table, in order basically for Parliament to make a proposition rather than to rule on an executive proposition, you can do that via an amendment. You don't really need, you know, the Parliament to take back control to do that. So there is stuff there that can work, if indeed that's what's in there. It's not quite the same as the much more sort of revolutionary, much more meaty approach that was there before. Dominic Grieve has used that mechanism before, remember. This is the one he used, you know, back in December, and he's used it to try to just turn it into a machine to suck up government sort of compromises, basically. And it didn't quite work out. And it can be harsh, you know, we can sort of look at when someone made a strategic decision. When it works, everyone's like, they're a genius. And when it doesn't work, they're like, oh, look, they fucked it out of sight. And he was being given a lot of sort of attacks on Twitter. And I kind of understand. I think he was just trying to find a way of getting the core thing that he was looking for onto the statute book in a way that might sort of be able to to bring the government with it. But I have to say, I do really think it was a big strategic error. I think when you look at that resignation in the morning, this was winnable, and it was winnable on the original terms. And now we're talking about compromises on his compromise arrangement, which does not seem to me to be enough. Tory rebels need to stop acting like time is on their side. It is the other fucking way around. The time is on the Brexiters' side. Mm. So this sort of war of attrition that they want to fight is the precise opposite of the strategy that they should be pursuing. And it makes it very, very hard to understand, I have to say, that the behaviour they've shown today makes it very, very hard to understand why Nicky Morgan's name is on an amendment next to Jacob Rees-Mogg's on a customs arrangement, God help me, which is like another plain fudge that even a five-year-old child could see. I do not understand why they're faffing about with this. This was the moment to take a stand, and it's very, very dispiriting to see that they haven't.
And finally, what are we expecting that's going to come out between now and Friday morning? What else is happening that's...
I have to take that. I mean, who knows? Maybe there's going to be a big customs upset. I really want to check my phone as I'm saying this, because it could be happening right now. But my expectation is that they're going to lose. That, you know, the government will be able to clear all of those hurdles. Then everything is about really... We've talked a lot about the self-identifying of Tory rebels, for instance, by that Telegraph page. Now, they went in to see Theresa May. Clearly, when you look at the stuff that Soubry's been saying on Twitter, they got some pretty certain assurances. I don't know what other kind of assurance you can get, but whatever. On the back of that, if it turns out that's not true, that could be a moment where they really realise, you know, we can't believe anything that they're telling us. And we have to, I think at this stage, that to me is kind of almost my big hope, that it isn't there. And they think, well, fuck it, well, then no more compromises. We tried, we did our bit, no more of that. But we have to wait and see, not just the end of this week, but the beginning of next.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. Thanks a lot for coming in, Rav. What are you expecting that's going to happen in the interim?
We'll see the amendment, perhaps due on Thursday. And then in the meantime, Brexit will almost certainly continue to be a very terrible idea.
Good to know. Thanks a lot, man.
Thank you.
The end of the show is coming up, which means it's time to choose something to go in our Brexit time capsule. This is where we stash away something for the future that we're going to miss if we leave the EU, or something that we'll need if we're out. Roz, it's your turn. What's going in the Brexit time capsule?
This is a controversial choice because arguably a lot of people are not going to miss MEPs. But I'd just like to talk briefly about MEPs. Bear with me. Because have a think about it. I mean, there are a number of MEPs sitting in the European Parliament. And in fact, there are going to be European elections only next year, in a year's time, at the end of May 2019, which we will not be voting in, which means our failed experiment with the Daunt voting system has come to an end. But moving on. So what is happening to these seats that the people like Nigel Farage formerly put their bottoms on? Well, 27 of them are going to be redistributed, mostly going to Italy, France and Spain. So it could well be that Emmanuel Macron's new party gets some of those. It could well be that the anti-EU movement in Italy at the moment, who've just elected, of course, an anti-EU prime minister, that they make some progress. And we could perhaps see a similar pattern there with what happened with UKIP in the European Parliament happening to Italian MEPs too. Maybe, maybe not. And then the other 46... are going to be reserved, and this is the great thing that I love, for expansion. Because the EU is always an optimistic organisation, and at the moment, despite what would happen if the EU tried to expand to the east at the moment, I mean, I frankly dread to think, given what Vladimir Putin has shown himself capable of doing, what would happen if other countries decided they wanted to join. It's reserving 46 just in case of EU expansion. Or perhaps they're thinking of going to North Africa, who knows?
God bless them.
I know.
We could all
it's
do.
Sweet, isn't it?
Give me the kind of ebullience of the EU official that decided to reserve those seats.
Or, you know, maybe we might rejoin and we could have them back.
Yay!
Yay.
Yeah, but only 46 of them as punishment, not the full lot.
For our European language clip, it's the return of one of our rock and roll Romaniacs. Here's Glenn Johansson of the indie band Echo Belly speaking Swedish.
Istället för att ha din kaka och äta den, varför äter du inte Boris Johnson?
And that's the end of the show. Now breathe out and relax with our theme tune Demon is a Monster by Cornershop and a roll call of our Patreon backers.
Hello and thank you from me to Nick Hall, Basil Arden, Philip Story and Tim Holt.
It's obrigado from me to Tanya Jane Park, John Das, Marianne Farrar-Hockley and Ben Knowles.
And Everisto from me to John O'Price, Richard Cohen, Nathan Nelson and Rachel Whitfield. We'll see you next week.
Romaniacs was presented by Dorian Linsky with Ian Dunt and Roz Taylor. Studio production was by Jack Claremont. Romaniacs is a Podmasters production.